Welcome to ID the Future. I am Brian Miller. Today I'll be talking with Paul Nelson about the theory of common descent. Dr. Nelson is a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute, an adjunct professor in the Masters of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. He is a philosopher of biology who has been involved in the intelligent design debate internationally for over two decades. Dr. Nelson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to begin by, first of all, asking you about the theory of common descent. Would you please explain the theory and how you became interested in studying it?
Sure. It's widely acknowledged that Darwin's major achievement as a scientist was not the theory of natural selection, important as that was, but rather persuading the scientific community that all living things on planet Earth descended from a single common ancestor in the distant past. This is typically referred to as the theory of common descent, sometimes the theory of universal common descent, and it's usually represented graphically or visually as a great branching tree of life. It's a very powerful image that and theory that occupies the imagination, the biological imagination of most scientists. When they think about the history of life on this planet, they have a picture in their minds of that great tree. Of course, at the tip of one of the branches is Homo sapiens, but E. coli, the bacteria in our large intestine, and heat-loving single-celled organisms in a hot spring in Yellowstone, or single-celled organisms in an Arctic zone. Every living thing on this planet, whether alive today or alive at some point in the past, finds its place somewhere in that great tree. So this representation of the history of life is very powerful. It has unifying features that most biologists are loath to give up. And I became interested in it as a graduate student for a couple of reasons. The first may seem rather strange, but it had to do with something I learned as an undergraduate. When I was studying evolutionary biology at the University of Pittsburgh, one of the predictions in my textbooks about common descent was that the genetic code, that is the 64 trinucleotide translation table by which information in nucleic acid is turned into or transferred to amino acid sequences in protein assembly, that the genetic code, because of its functional importance, should be universally conserved no matter what organism one examined. So you look at E. coli and compare E. coli again to Homo sapiens or to an oak tree or to a trout in a stream. No matter what organism one examined, one should find the same genetic code, because once the code evolved in the distant past and got up and running, it was so central to the molecular biology of the cell that it could not change and allow viability to be maintained. In other words, it was, as Francis Crick put it, was a frozen accident, frozen in place by functional necessity. So that's what I learned, 1980 to 1984, studying evolutionary biology, or just biology generally, at the University of Pittsburgh. Now, in the mid-80s, exceptions were discovered to the universality of the code. And in fact, today, the exceptions are so numerous that the National Center for Biotechnology Information maintains a web page where you should go and look up the code for your particular study group if your group uses a variant code. So, for instance, many ciliated protozoa, these are complex single-celled eukaryotes like Paramecium or Tetrahymena, use a variant code. They reassign their stop codons. In fact, the exceptions are so numerous that it's really important if you're working with one of these exceptional species that has a variant code that you look it up, because if you're working from DNA and you're trying to predict protein sequences, you'll get the protein sequences wrong if you translate the DNA through the so-called universal code. So here I am. I've learned this. It's a strong prediction from universal common descent. The code should be universal, except the code is not universal. So if you work out the logic of that, the prediction, strictly speaking, has failed. Now, someone has to pay for that failure. And when I say someone, what I mean is some theory or some assumption that we make about life on this planet, a failed prediction tells you something. So we can imagine coupling universal common descent, which is this abstract geometry of universal relatedness. We couple that to what we thought we knew about the functional invariance of the code, namely that it couldn't change. We generate a prediction, the code must be universal, except it's not. So we go back to our theoretical bundle and we ask, who's to blame? Who's to blame for this failed prediction? Now, in practice, almost without exception, evolutionary biologists looking at this puzzle said, what's to blame is not the theory of universal common descent. Rather, we didn't understand that the code could evolve. We were mistaken about that. All right, that caught my attention both as a biologist and a philosopher of science. Because if you do that, let's say not just with the genetic code, but with other features of all living things, and I could list dozens of examples like this. If you do that, you end up insulating universal common descent from empirical challenge. That is, the theory cannot be confronted with anomalies or failed predictions because those failures are absorbed by the theoretical bundle or the other theories to which common descent has been coupled. So, it's a long-winded answer, but it really turned on my philosophical radar that here was a really interesting puzzle about how one of the most general theories in biology, or arguably the most general theory in biology, because it applies to every living thing on the planet, was not being confronted with its failed predictions. So that's what got me interested. And I ended up writing my dissertation in Chicago on the topic. And in the intervening now almost 20 years, my interest in the question has only got deeper.
Oh, well, how is this issue relevant to the debate between neo-Darwinism and intelligent design?
Well, here's a funny aspect of this question. If you build yourself a matrix of opinion, and I'll be posting something on ENV with some figures so that people can see this graphically, but I'll just describe it verbally here. Let's do a matrix of historical opinion with four quadrants. So we have design and no design, and then we have single tree of life, multiple trees of life. Now that will give you a four quadrant matrix. It turns out that every quadrant in that matrix is populated by distinguished biologists of the past and present. So in one quadrant, we have no design, single tree of life. Within that space, we find Darwin, Stephen Jay Gould, the late Harvard paleontologist, Richard Dawkins, Jerry Coyne. Most evolutionary biologists are in that corner of the matrix. Then the best known other quadrant is design and multiple trees. So there we'd find Cuvier, the great pre-Darwinian French anatomist, Linnaeus, who gave us the Linnaean classification system, Louis Agassiz, the last great creationist in American academic life at Harvard, Jonathan Wells, Discovery Institute Fellow, and so forth. In the quadrant that is design single tree, we find some very distinguished intelligent design advocates like Mike Behe or Michael Denton. Arguably, Teilhard de Chardin, the French paleontologist, the Jesuit advocate of theistic evolution, is in that quadrant. Now, you might say, well, there's nobody in the quadrant that says no design, multiple trees. In fact, historically, in the 19th century, most evolutionists were in that quadrant. Ernst Haeckel himself, for instance, the German embryologist, thought that spontaneous generation was happening all the time and that the single-celled organisms we saw today were not the lineal descendants of single-celled organisms alive millions or billions of years ago. So under that schema, you'd have cells arising all the time, and that will give you multiple independent trees. So Ernst Haeckel is there. But in the 20th and 21st century, we find very senior National Academy of Science level evolutionary biologists saying, there wasn't any design, but there were multiple trees of life. So Carl Woese, for instance, who gave us the three-domain picture of the history of life, died a few years ago. He's in that quadrant. W. Ford Doolittle, a Canadian member of the National Academy of Sciences, very active today at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, For Doolittle is in that quadrant. So each section of our matrix of opinion is populated, which makes this question incredibly interesting from a historical standpoint, a philosophical standpoint, and of course a scientific standpoint. So it's not the case that you can simply oppose intelligent design to the neo-Darwinian single tree picture, because there are more options out there than the sort of polar debate that's most familiar to us between the neo-Darwinian picture of the history of life and intelligent design. I think the question is relevant in multiple senses, though, to the intelligent design neo-Darwinism debate. Because if it turns out, in fact, that life doesn't fall into a single tree, a single nested hierarchy, but in fact we have an orchard of trees with independent roots, and there's evidence of design, really, it's going to be very, very hard to say that you could have had that orchard or that forest of trees arising naturalistically. So there's certainly all kinds of implications to looking at the evidence that may indicate primordial or aboriginal discontinuity among living things. But I want to stress, as I've just said, it's not simply a polar opposition of two familiar positions. There are four possible views on this question.
Well, with that diversity of opinion, why do so many evolutionists defend it so strongly? Is it based on evidence or their assumptions?
Evidence and assumptions both play a role. There's no question that life exhibits remarkable, for instance, biochemical universals. All living things that we know have DNA, RNA, and protein. That's ubiquitous throughout the whole of life on this planet. All living things that we know have a genetic code, although the code itself is not universal. There are these features that we find in all of life, and it's quite natural to say, well, the reason that those features are universal is all life shares a common ancestor. Now, I think that's not the only possible interpretation, but I can see for a biologist how that would flow from the evidence available to him or her. But there are also, and I think even more critically, assumptions at play that need to be critically examined. In an upcoming seminar that I'll be doing online later this month, I'm going to argue that evolution, or more precisely, common descent, universal common descent, is not properly thought of primarily as a theory of similarity, but rather as a theory of transformation. And what I mean by that is similarities among organisms can have multiple possible causes, only one of which is material descent. And there are both theoretical and experimental reasons for saying that. There are many patterns that we observe in life that cannot be readily reconciled with transformation from a single common ancestor. And in a situation like that, one should not be compelled to force the data into a single tree geometry if, in fact, the data are providing a signal saying there is more than one tree here. The history of life on Earth doesn't fall naturally into that universal nested hierarchy that Darwin argued for. And let me mention something very interesting about Darwin before we go on. Darwin himself was ambivalent about whether he could sustain the single tree picture. And throughout the multiple editions of The Origin of Species, he said, look, it really doesn't matter if it's just one ancestor or multiple ancestors. What really mattered to Darwin was that he could derive most of the major groups. So, for instance, the vertebrates from a common ancestor. Now, as we come into the 20th century, for various reasons, that option fades away for the mainstream of evolutionary theory. But I think now in the 21st century, in the light in particular of genomic data, it's re-emerging as a live possibility for many evolutionary biologists.
What is some of the evidence that actually contradicts the idea of a single tree?
Well, some of it I will mention in another podcast dealing with so-called orphan or taxonomically restricted genes. But let me just perform a little thought experiment here for the listeners. I want to describe one of these features that turns out to be paradoxical when you think about a single common ancestor. So when a ribosome is moving down a messenger RNA strand, the ribosome will come to the end of the messenger RNA where there's a stop signal that tells the ribosome, stop translating here, and this baby polypeptide, this baby protein, needs to be set free to go off and fold and perform its function. Now, when the ribosome reaches that point, instead of a transfer RNA entering the ribosome and forming a peptide bond and bringing in another amino acid, a protein comes in called release factor that, in a sense, I won't go into the chemistry, but it hydrolyzes the ester bond there, holding the last transfer RNA and its amino acid in the ribosome, and then the polypeptide is released from the ribosome, the large subunit of the ribosome, and goes off and folds. Now, you think about the centrality of ribosomes to life. The ribosome is arguably the molecular machine for any cell on this planet. You have to be able to turn your nucleic acid into protein if you want to make a living as a cell. So it's central to life as we know it. So let's say by some unknown natural pathway, we get a ribosome up and working. It's doing its job. Release factor, that protein, is demonstrably essential to the function of the ribosome. So we've got a ribosome. It's present in the last universe. Universal common ancestor. It's got a release factor. The release factor is essential. Now take those facts and ask yourself what's likely to be the case if the last universal common ancestor existed, had a ribosome and release factor proteins. What's likely to be the case as we move out through the tree of life about any other cell in that tree? What will be the shape or what will be the form, the fold, molecular details of release factor? So release factor was solved. The crystal structure of that protein was solved for bacteria, and it was solved for a eukaryote, in fact, Homo sapiens. And it turns out those release factors are totally different proteins. They're doing the same job, namely they're snipping that baby polypeptide, that baby protein, free of the ribosome so it can go off and fold. But when you look at the structure, and you can do this, go to Protein Data Bank and download the three-dimensional form of bacterial release factor and eukaryotic release factor, those proteins are not the same. Totally different folds. Now, when this was discovered, the researchers who made the observations were scratching their head and they said, we didn't expect this. Coming into the question, we would expect a universally conserved release factor, and actually that's not true. You can march through different systems within the cell, making the same kind of thought experiment. Assume that single tree geometry and ask yourself, what should I expect to observe when I look at this or that essential biochemical or molecular system? And it turns out in a remarkable number of cases, your prediction goes belly up because the cells are not using the same molecular actors to perform these essential functions. So let's go back to the point I made earlier about the genetic code. You've got an abstract geometry that no one has observed, namely universal common descent, but we can couple that to other things we know about biology, auxiliary theories, let's say about cell function or how development works, or pick any part of biological knowledge, couple those two together and then make predictions about what you should expect to see when you go out and look at nature. If those predictions fail, as they do in an amazing number of cases, someone in that theoretical bundle has got to pay for the failed prediction. And the question is, why doesn't common descent pay? Now, when I first became interested in this, the typical pattern was evolutionary biologists would protect common descent from empirical challenge and make the auxiliary theory pay. So, gosh, the genetic code can evolve. We didn't know that. Or there must be some way for release factor to totally change its fold and still be functional and so forth. Well, over the past decade, that's happening less and less because more and more evolutionary biologists are now bailing out of that single tree picture. They're not becoming intelligent design advocates, but they're saying the early history of life on this planet must have involved multiple independent starting points to account for the molecular diversity that we see. So I think the next few years on this question are going to be remarkably interesting, given that something that I would have thought was impossible as a graduate student even, namely that biologists would be challenging this single tree picture, that's going to be happening more and more.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nelson. I very much enjoyed having you on the program to talk about the theory of common descent. For ID the Future, I am Brian Miller. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.